Morning, everybody. For those who don't know me, my home church is Lilydale, and I've been coming here for the last 6 months during my relationship with Tanisha. It's funny, in the last few months leading up to this, was not nervous at all. Yeah, that changed this morning. The last time I did this was 2 years ago. So, yeah, I really should have been practicing more. Context for today. 2 years ago at Lilydale, we have small groups similar to life groups here. And against my will, it was my turn to lead one at my church. And I came across and I thought of this idea. And at the end of the night, I thought to myself, I think this would be a really good sermon idea. But instead of letting my pastors do with that as they may, I had the awful idea of writing it myself. But here we are today. And I need some water because I'm a wreck. All right, let's begin. Follow me back to the year 2002. Thousands of people have arrived in Salt Lake City for the annual Olympic Winter Games. Of the events taking place is a 100-metre speed skating event. An Australian is competing amongst legends. To the crowd, the skaters glide across the ice and just go around the rink lap after lap. But for the Australian, whose past injuries make it very difficult for him to do it successfully, they've decided to retire after these Olympics. However, when two other skaters are disqualified, they're able to make it to the skate. They're able to make it to the finals. As one of five skaters, it's clear they're in over their head. As the race continues, the gap begins to widen between the skaters. All eyes are on the first four. The Australian is simply an afterthought. But as the other skaters enter the final lap, one loses their footing and all four come to a crashing stop. In utter disbelief to both fan and official alike, the Australian glides through the ice and goes across the finish line, winning Australia's first ever gold medal at the Winter Olympics. That's the story of how Stephen Bradbury became the unlikeliest national hero, leading the way for Australia to achieve five more gold medals over the next 20 years. The Bible contains unlikely heroes throughout the history of Israel. Moses defied Pharaoh, a god in the eyes of the Egyptians, and he freed the Hebrews. Esther saved her people from great danger by breaking the law. Paul travelled the world speaking to the Gentiles, something unheard of for a Jew. To their neighbours, they would have been unlikely witnesses to God's character. Some had a dark past, others claimed to be weak, others were viewed as simply being a woman. But God is different, and thankfully so. As an omniscient being, he does not define a person by their past, but by the choices they make in the moment. That is why we're going to compare some popular heroes. Thank you. That's why we're going to compare some popular heroes of the Bible to their life before and after God's intervention. You'll notice that some appear to be similar to others. Some earn authority in a foreign kingdom. Others speak with God directly, and even a few join the ancestry line of Jesus. I forgot to turn it on. Key? Oh, right. Apologies. I want to start with David, as the story sets a theme for today. In 1 Samuel 16, we see the start of his path to becoming the king of Israel before he challenged the giant that terrified the Israelite army. Now the Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I'm sending you to Jesse the Bethlehem. I'm sending you to Jesse, for I provided myself a king among his sons. And Samuel said, how can I go? If Saul hears it, he'll kill me. But the Lord said, take a heifer and say, I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. Then invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I'll show you what you shall do. You shall anoint for me the one I name to you. So Samuel did what the Lord told him, and he went to Bethlehem. And the elders of the town trembled at his coming and said, do you come peaceably? And he said, peaceably I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Sanctify yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice. Then he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. So it was, when they came, they looked at Eliab and said, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or his physical stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. So Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. And he said, neither has the Lord chosen this one. Then Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel. And Samuel said to Jesse, none of these have been chosen. And Samuel said to Jesse, are all the young men here? Then he said, there remains yet the youngest, and there he is, keeping the sheep. And Samuel said to Jesse, send and bring him, for we will not sit down till he comes here. I don't know about all of you, but if I had to wait for my brother, I would have just started eating. So he sent him and brought him in. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is the one. Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. There you go. Even Samuel did not look beyond the physical. In his defense, he had anointed Saul when he became king, and David's brothers would have reminded him of where he was in his youth. Now, jumping forward to 1 Samuel 17. Then David said to the Philistine, You come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. Then all this assembly will know that the Lord does not save with sword and with spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. David defeated a champion with absolutely no experience and a flimsy weapon. He should have not survived, let alone won. So how did he do it? He had spent years relying on God, knowing that he was greater than the lions and the bears that threatened his sheep. This was no different. God used David to show them all that God was greater than a giant that threatened his chosen people. If this young shepherd boy realized that, why couldn't they? The story of Moses begins with the miracle of a baby saved from the Nile River, but the miracle doesn't stop there. He was adopted by Pharaoh's daughter, but raised by his actual mother until he was four, when he was then returned to the palace. He knew he was a Hebrew, which is why it says in Exodus 2. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that way, and when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. The Hebrews rebuked the prince for his act of service, and I'd be surprised if that one Egyptian's death didn't lead to worse conditions for the Hebrews. After Pharaoh learned of the murder, he did not hesitate to try and kill his adopted grandson, who fled the country in response. According to Acts 7, verse 30, Moses was in Midian for 40 years, living a simple life until God approached him in a burning bush. God told Moses that he would deliver the Hebrews from 400 years of slavery, an approach that Moses strongly opposed. He gave every possible excuse not to return, arguing that First, he could not speak in public. I relate to that. And the people would never believe that he was sent by God. Knowing this, God had already sent his brother Aaron to speak in his place. With the support, Moses agreed to follow God's plan and showed many signs in Egypt. Finally, in Exodus chapter 12, then Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron by night and said, "Rise, go out from among my people, both you and the children of Israel, and go, serve the Lord as you have said. Also take your flocks and your herds as you have said, and be gone, and bless me also." A killer, given the chance to redeem his past, became the deliverer that God called him to be. A minor but instrumental figure in the Battle of Jericho, Rahab is first introduced in Joshua chapter 2. So the spies went and came to the house of a harlot named Rahab and lodged there. An escort living within the cities of Jericho, this is just one of many cities that stood in the way of the promised land. She must choose between giving up two Israelite spies or saving their lives. But if they escape the city, she knows Jericho will fall. News of Israel's escape from Egypt and their conquest has spread throughout Canaan, and the people are terrified. Rahab protected the spies because she knows that with their God, the city is already theirs. He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now swear to me by the Lord, since I have shown you kindness, that you'll also show kindness to my father's house. Rahab has risked everything for a God she does not know, and he repays her kindness. In Joshua 6, the Israelites marched across the city. The people blew their trumpets, and the army returned to their camp every day for 6 days. On the seventh day, they repeated it 7 times, to which Joshua cries out, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. Now the city shall be doomed by the Lord to destruction, it and all who are in it. Only Rahab shall live, she and all who are in there with in their house, because she hid the messengers that we sent." As the city crumbled and the people ran for their lives, the two spies rescue Rahab and her family from the window, keeping their promise to her. Leaving her old life behind, Rahab stayed with the Israelites and later gave birth to Boaz, great-grandfather of David. A pagan woman risked everything for enemy spies and was chosen by God to join the ancestry of Jesus. After the Israelites had settled in Canaan, they were often raided by the surrounding nations. In response, God chose judges from among the common people to lead them against their attackers into an era of peace. After the judge would pass away, the people would return to worshipping their idols, God would take away their protection, and the cycle would continue for 400 years. Gideon is one such judge, approached by God to lead Israel against the Midianites, though he himself calls himself a weak and uninspiring individual. "Oh my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house." Gideon put God to the test, claiming that if he found a wet woolen fleece on dry ground, that was all the proof he needed. For a God that created the ground he walked on and the air he breathed, Gideon wasn't thinking very big. But God accepted the challenge and did just that. But Gideon still wasn't convinced and asked for more. Now the fleece should be dry, surrounded by wet ground. After God did that too, Gideon was finally satisfied that he spoke the truth. Drafting over 30,000 men to fight the Midianites, Gideon was confident in their chances. However, God gave them 2 tests, bringing that number down to only 300 men. Gideon was terrified, but God understood his fears and encouraged him to spy on the Midianites. He heard them discuss God giving victory to the Israelites, and it was then that Gideon knew God was in control. dividing his army into three lots of 100 men. We read in Judges 7 that the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers. They held the torches in their left hands and the trumpets in their right. And they cried, "The Lord, sword of the Lord and of Gideon." And every man stood in his place all around the camp. And the whole army cried and ran out and fled. Gideon and his men were the anvil, but God was the hammer that broke the Midianites' terror over Israel, leading to over 40 years of peace. Gideon, a coward that tested God, became the warrior that led Israel to victory. Now, what can we say about Daniel? He was only a young man when the kingdom of Judah was invaded by Babylon. A Jewish noble, Daniel was forced to watch as the people of Israel were enslaved, the temple ransacked. Now, the king instructed Ashpenaz to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish and good looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand. Daniel, his three friends, and other young nobles were selected to serve in the Babylonian court and learn their ways. Out of all the other young Jewish men, Daniel and his friends remained faithful to their God, and they were blessed with better health and wisdom in return. But after King Nebuchadnezzar's dream in Daniel 2, he demands that his wise men explain its meaning and becomes furious when they can't. Ordering the execution of all wise men in Babylon, Daniel asks for one more day with the purpose of an explanation. That night, God reveals that the dream shows the future of the world through rise and fall of powerful empires. The king said, "Truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." Then the king promoted Daniel, and he gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon. Daniel may have started as a captive, but his faith and his wisdom led to his rise as governor in one of the most influential empires in ancient history. In the legend of Esther, God's influence is present, even though he isn't mentioned anywhere in the book. Esther 1 explained that after King Xerxes banished Queen Vashti from the kingdom, he didn't take very long to try and replace her. When introduced to Esther, we are told that the young woman was lovely and beautiful. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her his queen. Shortly afterwards, Xerxes is told by his advisor that the Jews living in his kingdom do not respect his authority and do not follow his laws. In response, the king decrees that for one day on a certain date, citizens could kill their Jewish neighbors in exchange for a large reward. But why did the advisor, Haman, manipulate him this way? He was the king's right-hand man. To disrespect Haman was to disrespect the king. When Mordecai the Jew refused to bow, Haman began to hate him. The death of the Jews would be a welcome bonus with Mordecai's death. When Mordecai learns of the decree, he secretly meets with the new queen. Not only is she a Jew, she is also his cousin. Mordecai begs Esther to save her people, knowing that she cannot appear in the king's presence uninvited. When he refuses, he doesn't give up. When she refuses, he doesn't give up, but challenges her. Who knows whether you will have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Let's touch on that briefly, a line that could be read without a second thought. You could even replace it with, who knows whether God has placed you in the kingdom for such a time as this? Mordecai was right. She was the only one that could make a difference. With an incredible amount of courage, Esther risked everything to enter Xerxes' court, and he welcomed her warmly. With time, she exposed Haman's plot and save the Jews from destruction. Who would have thought that Esther, an orphan girl in a foreign land, became the queen that her people needed her to be? Saul is first seen in Acts 7 during the death of Stephen, before the widespread persecution of Jesus' followers. As a member of the Pharisee order, he made havoc of the church, entering every house and dragging off men and women, committing them to prison. On his way to imprison more believers in Damascus, Saul is struck with a vision and is left blind. While his men lead him to the city, God tasks a man with Ananias to go and visit him. But Ananias pleads with God. This man's reputation alone has terrified the local believers. But the Lord said to him, "Go, for he is a chosen vessel of mine to bear my name before Gentiles, kings, and the children of Israel. For I will show him how many things he must suffer for my name's sake." Trusting God, Ananias visits Saul, praying over him and restoring his sight. Instead of arresting such a prominent member of the early church, Saul is baptized and begins to preach the gospel, slowly embracing his Roman name, Paul. While the 12 apostles planted roots among the Jewish people, their outreach to the Gentiles showed little movement. This is where Paul's mission and God's plan for him starts. As a former member of the Pharisee order, Paul was a gifted, intelligent, and experienced debater, and his Roman citizenship allowed him to move throughout the empire that the apostles did not have. The city of Athens, for example, was rich with philosophy and pagans. That is why Paul reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and Gentile worshippers, and in the marketplace daily with certain Epicurean and Stoic philosophers that encountered him. And some said, "What does this babbler want to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a proclaimer of foreign gods," because he preached to them Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to the city council of Athens, saying, "May we know what this new doctrine is of which you speak? For you are bringing some strange things to our ears. Therefore, we want to know what all these things mean." Peter and the other apostles couldn't dream of spreading the gospel to a place like Athens, filled with academics so close to the Roman capital. But these were Paul's people, and he knew how to appeal to their curiosity. This is how the gospel began to spread further than Judea. A relentless persecutor, almost crippling the early church's growth, Paul instead became one of its greatest messengers. On their own, these well-known stories of action, romance, and mystery. But I believe each person was a twist in a story that no one saw coming, even themselves. David believed in God's strength and defeated a giant warrior. Moses used God's miracles to lead the Hebrews out of 400 years of slavery. Rahab trusted God's mercy and saved her family. Gideon believed in God's strength to defeat an invading force. Daniel trusted in God's wisdom to relieve the king's fear. Esther used God's courage to risk her life for her people. And Paul showed God's love to the Jews and the Gentiles alike. But the main theme I found in each story was their faith, examples we can relate to in our own lives today. David had faith that God is greater than our fear. Moses had faith that God was watching over him. Rahab had faith that God would accept anyone, anywhere. Gideon had faith that God was in control. Daniel had faith that God is wise and just. Esther had faith that God had a plan to protect his people. And Paul had faith in God's word that it can be shared with anyone. Since Jesus' ministry, unlikely men and women have been called to continue the task of spreading the gospel. Most live their entire lives in private, the world never knowing who they are what they did, and what they gave up. But for some, like Billy Graham, their ministry can reach the world. Raised on a farm, Billy was baptized at 15 and became the pastor of a local Baptist church at 21. It wasn't much, but it was his. After World War II, his evangelism journey began with crusades, but he struggled with the community's lack of interest. And yet, because of the faith in his mission, he convinced his team to contribute more resources to their meetings, attracting larger audiences and allowing for a growing media coverage. After nearly 60 years, Billy had led 417 crusades across the globe in both crowded cities and remote villages, a friend and advisor to many world leaders. But even with all he had accomplished, Billy explained to all that I'm just communicating the gospel in the best way I know how. Doug Batchelor is an Adventist evangelist with one of the largest media presences in modern times, but has not always viewed Christianity in a positive light. His father was a wealthy pilot and a businessman. So while Doug lived in luxury, he struggled to satisfy his hunger for happiness and chose to run away from home. Turning to a life of crime and drugs, Doug took positive teachings from several major religions to create his own doctrine. After his father found him, he was told to come home and fix his life, and he did try. But the pressure became too much for him to handle, and he ran away again to a mountain cave. It just so happens that a Bible was left in this cave, which he initially ignored, but went on to read it in order to challenge believers in the town below. But over time, he started to believe that not only was what it said true, but Jesus was the Son of God, and he asked God right then and there to forgive him. Since that prayer up in the mountains, Doug turned his life around and has used his experience to teach others that if you want happiness, it comes from Jesus by asking. I know what it's like to be part of the unlikely. I spent a large part of my life living in the background, in fear of being judged if I ever spoke up. Growing up in Sabbath school, we were invited to share our thoughts on the lesson. I was terrified of making myself look like a fool in front of everyone. I still want to take part. Sorry. Oh, yeah. Practicing does not help you for that. I still want to take part, but over the last few years, still want to take part, so I'd whisper them to my brother, who would speak on my behalf. It's taking too long. Oh, be the ultimate embarrassment to cry in front of church. Over the last few years, I've been able to put myself out there at my own home church, speaking more in group discussions and getting involved in the service. But as it turns out, being unlike what anyone expected can be the best thing for everyone. Whew. Not only does someone take a risk to step outside the comfort zone, but others pay more attention to something they weren't expecting. You don't need to be the smartest person in the room or the greatest public speaker around. Helping those in need, getting involved in music, leading a life group, these are all simple ways to put ourselves out there. This is my opportunity. What will be yours?